I asked her to tell me a little bit about herself, and she said, "The most important thing I can tell you about myself is I am a member of Al-Anon." Linda has worked at the World Service Office for some time. She worked the first 11 years as a staff writer, and during that time she was involved in the writing and the production of much of Al-Anon's conference-approved literature. She sort of stressed that, so I thought I'd pass on the little underlining and italics there. Mainly, the Blueprint for Progress. I don't know about how I feel about that. Living with Sobriety and Understanding Ourselves and Alcoholism. Today, she is the literature secretary in the World Service Office, and she, I'm just going to let it go at that. She told me lots more, but I'm just going to let it go at that. She can tell you more about it if she wants to, if she thinks that you need to know. Please help me welcome Linda.
She said, "Go get him, squirt." I'm exhausted. How much? Let me begin this way. First of all, the flowers on my head are not a crown. They are, however, a symbol of honor from Hawaii, and they were a gift from my friend Serafina. And it's my understanding that somebody climbed high into the mountains and got the flowers that only grow above a certain level, so that they're a sign of honor and elevation. And I've worn them so that Serafina knows how much they mean to me. But since we're at an Al-Anon meeting, I think she'll understand if I take them off at this point. The next thing I want to do that's very important by way of thank yous is to tell you that I couldn't be more honored nor more grateful for being invited here. She's now directing me how to do my hair, too. Thanks, Serafina. We're under control. Speak for yourself. I've rolled up my sleeves. I'm trying to begin. But I need to thank you very much. Your committees have served all of us very well, and me especially. I want you to know I reside in the presidential suite, which has a bed big enough for at least four of us who would never touch one another. That tells you something about presidents. Or at least what hotels think of them. I'm especially grateful for that. I'm especially grateful for the California sun, the warmth of your own hospitality. I have been feted and wetted and petted. And I think I would be remiss if I didn't thank personally all the people who took such wonderful care of me, and for those who even thought to invite me. My heart is here, my daughter is here, my friends are here, and believe me, considering last week's events, it's also a miracle that I am here. And so let me say that I can at last begin. My name is Linda, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Now, if you think it's easy for people to come a distance and just fit right in, it does happen in Al-Anon, perhaps in AA. Certainly, it's been my experience that I've always felt at home when anyone ever told me that they were an Al-Anon member. But I feel especially home here. I didn't always expect that Al-Anon would be my life's goal. And after seeing the skit this evening, I really wondered what on earth I was going to say. You see, that entire production was based loosely on my life. And so I've decided that since the story has been told, I mean, and that's my story, and the lives and loves of Linda, you know, I didn't love a Stanley, but I certainly loved a steamer. And I decided that what I would do is try to fill in the places where they missed. I wasn't born a writer. I was certainly born with a way with words, because my first real memory of people's reaction to me was my grandfather pulling me up on his knee and saying, you know, come up and sit with me, my darling little chatterbox. So, you know, people tend to rise to the level of other people's expectations. And, you know, I just maintained that forever, and words became my way with the, you know, of relating to other people. Lots and lots of words. And I really prayed this evening that I would be inspired enough to be worth everything that everybody has done for me. And then I decided that I would be a poor Al-Anon member indeed if I didn't feel that I at least deserved to be invited. Now, whether or not I deserve to stay, and God, I would love to. I really would love to. Okay, so I like to begin at the beginning and fast forward as fast as I can, you know, so that you don't have to go through that entire story. But I think if there had been a little prologue to the play, you would have found a child like me, along with some of the other children who are finding their way into Al-Anon today. I didn't grow up with alcoholism. I grew up with parents who expressed a great deal of affection for one another and a great deal of affection for me, my two sisters, and a brother. I remember lovely summers in the country, interesting and exciting winters in New York City. In fact, I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I even got the Dodgers before you guys did. And I had a good childhood. And yet I'm in this room this evening. And I think that that play was mine, as it was even the children who did grow up with drinking in their home, because it expressed a number of things we have in common. So I think that's the best I can do is to fill in. I had an interesting and wide chance at living. Things were brought into my life that were exciting. Opera on Saturday filled the house, and I can remember, you know, thinking how exciting that was. The friends and family that my parents allowed me to, you know, to come to meet and to know. The house was always full of people, and they were my friends too, and my parents were very good about that. They let me have all my friends in, and they supported everything I did. And I've read a lot of actresses and actors' biographies because I'm an avid reader, and they've spilled into my life too. And I know that I had a lot in common with a great many of them. So I'm not going to apologize for who I am, but by way of explanation, I want you to know that I was a little playwright when I was younger, and I wrote I wrote the scripts for plays and acted in them and had my family act in them, and my mother helped me make scenery, and all the neighborhood children came in, and my mother served them lemonade and welcomed them, and you know, she thought I was hot stuff. I've written lots of scripts since, you know, that were loosely based on reality, but of course I wrote the best parts for myself. And for those of you who have heard me speak in Southern California, I am a little at a loss, because the story is the same, but if you will bear with me, in the last few months, I think I've had some other insights into my life. You know, when we are asked to put the past to rest in Al-Anon, and I've been in Al-Anon a long time, that's what I did. I put a lot of it to rest, and so many of the things that I remembered, you know, I remembered just in a surface way. And so I had the opportunity, my higher power in his infinite wisdom and very strange sense of humor, decided that I should look back again. And so even though I know the same things happened to me that I've been telling people happened to me for years, I also know other things happened to me, so I'll throw a few of them in. I'm sure that there would be people who would relate the attribute of people-pleasing to the fact that I like to be on stage. You know, you're probably right. I have a new theory about life, and that is that everything is probably a little of something. Isn't that profound? But as I got older and knew more, I knew less. You know, I had a great deal of trouble later on in life learning new math. I was required to teach it. And I remember thinking, you know, why do I have to learn this whole vocabulary, this whole approach to life again? this whole approach, a whole new language for something that's so simply understood and learned by heart. And I think it's just to give us an idea of what's out there. But I'll tell you this about myself. I still don't think that I was very different as a child than I've thought for a long time. I think I was pretty much interested in the day, and that I was more than willing to stop and smell the flowers. I was in love with everything. I remember especially that for as long as I can remember, I've been impassioned by things. That I felt things fully and in an exciting way. And you know that story about the pony and the house full of horse manure? I always thought in a pile of horse manure there was a pony. I mean, I was an optimist. I know that I was. And I don't think that I've changed very much. And I'm grateful that I haven't changed very much. Because, you see, I don't think our personalities change as much as perhaps some people wish our personalities would change when they look at us and take our inventory for us. However, I do think attitudes can change, but I think I've had pretty much the same personality all along, and it's been wonderful and it's been terrible for me, so I don't apologize for it anymore. I grew up late. I mean by that I didn't come full flower into womanhood until I was 15. I was blessedly ignorant because I already told you I was impassioned with flowers, and you have to know what happened to me at 15. I just turned on another jet, and the heat stream included boys. And if I hadn't been as mature as I was at the time, I'm sure I probably would have been, you know, in a great deal of trouble. But I know that I changed for them. I changed who I was and what I wanted and who I thought I could be, so that I could be around boys. I just thought they were hot stuff. And since I was hot stuff, you know, the boys seemed the perfect partner for something like that. So I did just about everything I could to alter who I was so that I could be with them. And I recognized that that was people-pleasing, and it was, I thought, you know, fairly clever. And I wrote my little script so I could be with the boys, too. I enjoyed their company, and I thought they enjoyed mine. Of course, I was more than willing to give them my homework and to play dumb, because in the 50s you had to play dumb in order to be with the fellows, that you weren't supposed to have a life of your own. You know, it's really interesting, and I'm not an ardent feminist or anything like that. Please understand, I've never lost my passion for men, which makes that story all the more poignant for me. but I do know that when you surrender some of your own reality so that you can have something else, you're really not gaining anything. You're losing something. And see, I thought it was worth the price to pay. So what if I didn't win at tennis if I was better? I could afford to lose. So what if I didn't answer the question or every third question in class? I could afford to let the boy next to me see the answer on my page and owe me a little debt of gratitude. See, I operated out of a Chubette mentality. They're laughing. You know, I remember this. One of the stores actually had a label that said Chubette. And, you know, my mother took me into that department. That's where I got my clothes. I mean, it was sewed across my neck, you know, that I was something I didn't want to be. Of course, I realized that as a third girl, you know, all that psychology, it's the chances are that I was making my own little statement about not wearing the hand-me-down clothes or anything like that. But I had to change who I was, but I decided to affect my fantasy world or my dream world rather than my reality to fit in. And so, you know, I began to slice away a little of Linda in order to have something else I thought was of greater value. I recognized something else, too, recently, that as a child of depression parents, I was taught very definitely, and I understand why they did it, that's how they had to live, but I was taught to make do. Now, that was a virtue in the 40s and the 30s, but didn't serve me well too much later. because I thought that's all I deserved. And so looking back just recently, I noticed those things about myself. Now, when I got to college, and I wanted to go to college, I wanted desperately to be a lawyer. And I was admitted to a very prestigious law school under this plan that if you got into the college and you did well in the first 3 years, you could begin law school in the fourth year of college. And all you had to do was opt for that plan when you got to the end of the third year, and I was accepted in this program. Now, what made this unusual was that it was a Roman Catholic university in New York City, and I happened to be an Episcopalian. Well, if one wants to be accepted in a school where one is the only non-Roman Catholic, and acceptance seemed very important to me, you know, I had to surrender a little bit of my reality. And I was thinking about this just recently, and one of the things that I did when I went there is I didn't tell anybody that I was an Episcopalian. And so I adopted the vocabulary of all the others so they wouldn't know that. And you see, they could find that out because I said things in a very different way. I almost let it slip that I went to church. They went to math. And I remember all kinds of things like obligation. Oh, there were a lot of days of obligation that had to do with Roman Catholicism, and you know, we just had choice as Episcopalians, so I had to be obliged to go. And it was a long time before I let anybody know. I always thought that I was resisting their attempts at conversion. But in truth, now that I look back at it, I didn't let them know that I was different because I wanted so to fit in. I remember, too, coming home in tears after a few days of college. I had gone to this junior college Packer, where I was, you know, what is called a big fish in a little pond, and I'd gone to this big university, and I felt that I hadn't made friends and that I was going to be friendless. I remember today being very concerned about that. And my mother said to me something she had said to me often. I never realized that I didn't think the way she did, although I always thought I did, because she said to me, why would you think that way? And I said, well, you know, I've come in my third year, and most of the people have made their friendships, and they know people. And my mother said to me, well, you know, I think the best way to have a friend is to be one. And she said, why would you want everyone to like you anyway? Her mother had been an actress. The genes are there, folks. And her mother had said to her, if everybody likes you, said my mother, trying to soothe my feelings, if everybody likes you, don't you know that you're either a liar or a fool? And you see, I had been willing to be either one. I remember that I didn't let my mother know that. So I refused the help in that sense that I could have gotten just by sharing that with my mother, because she'd shared in such an open way with me and always shared her home and her life with all of us in such an open way. So I've looked back lately and I've seen those things, and they're not perhaps the most likable things. I also remember my first decision to try Roman Catholicism. And of course, it was not based in a reality. It was based in wishful thinking. You see, one of the things they had done for me in this Roman Catholic university was to seat me in the middle of the room with all the other middle of the room initials. Yes, they sat everybody alphabetically. It was a highly structured school. A could not sit with Z. I noticed that in registration the other day, and it was P to Z, and I thought, isn't that funny? You know, Z's were all alone at that end of the table. And, you know, most of the people in this university were in the middle of the room, because it was a Roman Catholic university that served the Irish and Italian population. And I don't know, but if you, of New York, and if you know anything about all those names, most of them begin with M. A lot of Italian names begin with L and M. And my father's parentage had been Italian, and my mother was as WASPy as they come. And they'd managed to get together and have a very nice life without either one of them surrendering who they were, because I knew they were very distinct personalities. And they'd each maintained their own religions and their own heritage. But, you know, I wanted so to fit in. And I sat with the M's, my last name beginning with L, and so the MCs came next. And you know, I sat down next to Stanley. Only that wasn't his name, but, you know, he was light-skinned and blue-eyed and dark-haired, and he looked like Errol Flynn without a mustache. And you have to remember I had a Chubette mentality, and I thought that that was the greatest gift God could give me, was to sit me next to somebody who was so good-looking. Now, today we would call that shallow. In my day, we were lucky. And he liked me. Well, I assumed that he liked me because he talked to me, and he talked to me a lot. And because he was engaged to somebody else, I felt free to talk to him. That's something else I just remembered about myself, and that was that, you see, I figured that anybody who was taken, that the girlfriends would not find me a threat, and therefore I was free to be as interesting or as interested as I cared to be. And that's not terribly nice about myself, but I thought I'd share that with you because I just discovered that about myself. And I've already confessed to almost anybody who would listen that once this young man professed that he loved me, Roman Catholicism grew to very large proportions spiritually, emotionally, and physically in my mind as an opportunity for me to fit in. And truly, to have the other thing that I always knew that I wanted besides a boy or a man in my life, to have the certainty of everlasting love and togetherness. You know, they invented togetherness, I think a major magazine invented the term togetherness in the 50s while I was going to school. Now, I will admit, as a literary resource, McCall Magazine is not exactly what anybody hoped I would get from college, but I got that idea, folks, that I was going to be promised togetherness if, in fact, I could do one of two things. I could blend in, and I could sign myself up with a religion that would guarantee me what I also think I wanted when I went to school, which was heaven. You know, I was a very idealistic and passionate and impassioned person, but I really thought it would be nice to end my life as a good girl and I could go to heaven. And one of the things they taught us in this school in the 50s is that you did not go to heaven alone. There are people nodding. You did not go to heaven alone. If, in fact, you got married, that took care of the heat. And if you had children and you stayed with this person forever, you were guaranteed a place up there with St. Peter. I mean, it was written. They taught it to us. I heard it. And I certainly heard it around the lunch tables. And it was a terrific reason for changing my religion. So I did. I simply chose to be a Roman Catholic. One of the things you had to do in order to be a Roman Catholic, in addition to being baptized, and I'd already been baptized twice, you had to be confirmed, and that meant I had to get unconfirmed and get confirmed. And then you had to go to confession. Now I want you to know I was a good girl, but I feared that first confession so much that I lied. That's not what they taught me. However, I just surrendered a little tiny piece of my reality so I could have the greater good, which was to get the partner for the heat and have somebody that would guarantee I would go to heaven, and that would take care of the lie because I could spend a little time in purgatory and get rid of that. So, yes, that was called a venial sin as opposed to a mortal sin, which is kind of like a minor revision and a major revision in literature. Some of them are conference approved and some of them are not. So I surrendered a little more of Linda in order to become Mrs. But I was guaranteed that I wouldn't have to surrender the heat, just so long as I didn't do anything about it. You know what I mean? The other thing they taught me to do in this school was to count. And I kid you not, the dean of the school who talked to us before we were married told me how to count and told me what I should count and what I should count on and what I should not count on and how I would feel and what it would mean to our relationship if I never said no. Now, if in fact you're taught to count, as I was taught to count in this college, you would have to say, no, 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 a lot, because otherwise it was yes, you know, from the gynecologist. Am I? Yes. So we began a life, you know, that was a little different from reality. And, I have to tell you that they were right. If you don't say no, somebody says yes, and they said yes on several occasions. As a matter of fact, I was always very grateful to find out that I was pregnant, because then I could stop worrying about getting pregnant, and I could have a good and meaningful relationship with my husband where I wouldn't have to say no. So I was always pregnant. I was always pregnant 7 times. Within the first 10 years, I mean, I was on my way to heaven monthly. So that was the answer for the heat. That was the answer for heaven. That was the answer for my willingness to surrender who I was so that I could be part of something else, in order to be part of something else, in order to have something that I wanted more than wanting to have something on my own. Are you following me so far? I told you I learned a great deal in college. This is called, I believe it's called Augustinian logic. I mean, they were always talking about how many angels were not on the head of a pin and whether or not your grandchildren were potential or real. My grandchildren were definitely real and potential at the same time. I must admit that my children didn't bother to go to college to learn how to count, and I only have one grandchild, because they learned to count on other things. Of course, I was promised that if I got married, I could count on my husband to be the head of the household while I became the heart. These two disembodied creatures were going to go to heaven and were going to make major decisions about life. There was only one problem. I didn't drink, and he did. Now, my father had told me before I was married not anything about the heat and certainly not anything about counting, because he was the Roman Catholic of the pair of my parents, and I think he was secretly quite pleased that at least one of the children had made it into the faith that he'd chosen for himself. And, you know, he could count on the grandchildren perpetuating this religion. But he had called me aside, and he had said that he felt it was necessary for him to say to me what he had learned through his experience. Now, here comes another reality, right? Here's my father, who's now well into his 40s, who is about to explain to me a certain fact of life in Brooklyn. And that was that it came to his understanding that the Irish drink. Now, I'm terribly sorry, sir, from Dublin, but that's what he told me. Now, I have been more than willing to accept a great many things from my father. Certainly through his hard work, the times in the country. Certainly through his hard work, the nice house in town. Certainly through his hard work, nice schools and piano lessons and art lessons, and certainly through his love of opera, the opera on Saturday, and through his love of learning, my own burning desire to continue my education, which, by the way, I was very willing to surrender as soon as I thought I was going to have the partner who was the greater good than my continuing education. Of yes, of course, I gave up law school because I was going to be Mrs. Somebody. And I was going to give myself to that magnificent-looking head. And I could be content just to have a heart full and other things full. You know when you get pregnant, you have to change the way you walk? I'm sure all of you have noticed that. That pregnant women have to shift because their center of gravity is different. And you know, I got used to looking at life over the hill. So, if you take that little play, you know, and catch it up to where we are, the only thing they didn't add in there, you know, were all these little pity-patting feet. And, you know, they seemed to be, at least, a wonderful opportunity to make do with somebody else's, you know, value system, but to make do. And, God, you know, they were all born with such darling, round, little Irish faces and little bow mouths. And you know, it was better than opening a bridge hand, you know, for the first time. Every time I'd see one of those little kids and I'd think, oh, my God, you know, that's part of me. And, you know, I just was impassioned. I told you that. So I was impassioned with having children. And I did the things I was impassioned, and I didn't do too much thinking. After all, I didn't have a head anymore. I was only a heart, and it was always beating. And it was usually beating for somebody else in some other way. You know, having been just slightly altered by a pacemaker that lived in another person. That's what I said. So I really began to live other people's lives in a big way. It was hard remembering what I had named all of those children. It was especially difficult when they were running by en masse, especially if they had friends in. They always had little friends in, because after all, my mother had little friends in, so of course the pattern was set. I had to have little friends in too, and I had to have, let them play with their puppets and let them have their little backyard shows. And so I was very busy, and I didn't notice at first that my head was doing what my father said it might be doing. You know, swallowing a little extra booze here and there. We went off for life in the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps insists that you go off for life in the Marine Corps. They're not terribly interested in whether or not you have a wife. And there was a line that they used to give us, and that was, if the Marine Corps wanted you to have a wife, they would have issued you one. You see, I decided I would be the best Marine Corps wife that anybody could have. If I wasn't going to be a little playwright or a big playwright or a lawyer, I would be the best Marine Corps wife. Now, you would have thought that I might have made an effort to learn the difference between a dress uniform, or let's say the uniform of the day. I knew the dress uniform because it was a different color from all the other uniforms. But the Marine Corps dress of the day for young officers was gabardine. And it's an entirely different wool from worsted, which was a less dressy outfit that Marines wore, just a shirt, a tie, and worsted pants. But the gabardine was a blouse that, you know, fit these wonderful figures who all looked like Errol Flynn without a mustache once they put those caps down over their eyes, you know. I remember one of my children rushing out on the parade field saying, Daddy, 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 Daddy. Of course, I was pregnant, and I had to run out on the field and grab him back and say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, you know. But all these guys were Daddy. We had to prepare for inspection. I bought that. We had to prepare for inspection. Now, I want you to know, each year I was having another baby in the Marine Corps, but we had to prepare for inspection. And I bought the idea that I was going to be the best Marine Corps wife, so I was the one who was responsible for taking the uniforms to the cleaners so they could have razor-sharp creases, you know, and be in good, clean shape when we had these inspections. Well, we also had brown paper coverings from the dry cleaners in those days. You know, I'm sure they had invented plastic. I'm not that old. But they used brown paper to cover up these outfits. So I, you know, dutifully took this outfit off to be dry cleaned, took it off the, you know, at the ready, like Blondie, another one of my heroes, which is funny, you know, and as this man passed through my life at 4:30 in the morning to go to the base, oh, we got up at 4:30 in the morning for these inspections, I dutifully handed him his clean uniform for inspection and kissed him goodbye and sent him on his way and then did all the things I needed to do for all the other people I was living for and through. I made a classic error. Oh, I sent the gabardine blouse to be cleaned, but I sent worsted pants along with it. And when he opened up this bag to get dressed for this inspection out there on the field, you know, in the bachelor's barracks where they prepared for this inspection, because married or not, they had to show up at the bachelor's barracks for inspection, you know, to his horror, he had not the uniform that he was supposed to have. Now, I want you to know that it was 3 days before he spoke to me about this, but I did finally find out the story. As a matter of fact, it was 3 days before he spoke to me. He had to go up and down the line begging like a trooper for someone else to loan him a pair of trousers that he could wear in this inspection. And he did finally happen on a lanky 6'3", he being only 5'11". He happened on a 6'3" pair of clean trousers, which he had to hike up under his armpits and cinch tightly with the belt across his own chest. Now, it made no difference that his higher power and mine had seen fit to have his major tap him on the shoulder and say to the man in the inspection line with the major, "Give this man a chit for the best hanging pants in the line." Funny, you're very funny. Because, you see, he knew that sooner or later that same major was going to ask to see his tie clip and he would have had to unzip his fly to show him. This was the way the head of the family was beginning to think. Fearfully. Now, the head and the heart went to the great Marine institution called Happy Hour. All you could drink for $1.50 on a Sunday afternoon. Now, you have to know something else about me. I didn't drink. I thought it was wonderful to take me to Happy Hour because, you see, for $1.50... this man who deserved to drink, in spite of my father's warnings, I felt this man deserved to drink after having such a hard week and living with such a poor Marine Corps wife as I was turning out to be. And so I didn't realize that I didn't care for the drinking. I just knew that I didn't care for Sunday evenings too much anymore. And Mondays seemed to be harder and harder on us. Another thing that became harder and harder on us, head and heart of the family, was going home. The Marine Corps loves to have its bases in places that no man would build a home, and certainly no woman would choose to go. Deep in the South with the chiggers and the swamps, you know, are some of the loveliest almost housing for families of and friends of Marine Corps young lieutenants. And it always meant that if we were going to go home for the holiday, we had to drive 800 miles or so. And I loved the holidays. There was just one trouble with them. I suffered for them. And I had to submit myself in a great many ways to a whole new script. In order to have the greater good, I had to give up something else. I had to roll up my sleeves and work harder. Because if, in fact, I wanted the kind of holiday I wanted, you know, it was the reflection of a great deal of work. And I noticed that I was going to have to do that work by myself. But that was all right, you see. I was making do. And usually the holiday didn't turn out too well. And I certainly wasn't going to admit that my father was, you know, in any way in charge of the reason, nor his thinking. I just knew that what I had wanted for myself wasn't, you know, going to come tomorrow. And it wasn't even going to come around holiday time when the gift-giving and the fellowship was over. Because, you see, I, as anxious as I was, and I felt I was the only one, after all, I was the heart, as anxious as the heart was to return home and to go and have the holidays, the head was needing to be convinced. So I was always having to convince the head of the family of the rightness of packing up all the children and packing up all the presents and driving all that way, you know, to visit. Well, the strange part about it was that as hard as it was for me to convince him to go there, it was twice as hard for me to convince him it was time to go home from there. And I always got back a script that, you know, that I hadn't written. People said things like, you know, "Are you the man of the family?" When I would say, "Don't you think it's time to go?" And, you know, I would take that. I know that I didn't argue about it. I know that I certainly didn't stick up for myself. I just rolled up my sleeves and decided that I would have to work harder and I would have to make do with the situation. And so I would put the kids in the car and the presents in the car, and then I would do my best, you know, to get the head of the household not to drive 800 miles home. And I soon learned that the later we left, the more likely it was that he was not going to drive, and I would drive. And I would drive that distance, you know, well into the morning light, and arrive at this, at our little quarters, and they were always too little, because each year, you know, we were solving the problem of birth control. Take all the kids out of the car and the presents all out of the car, and then go back and take the bear out of the car. And, you know, I had to prevent our hangover. I did that by having milk and aspirin at the ready, and turning down, of course, nice clean sheets. And the suffering was real, but I couldn't come up with a real solution for ending it. I would have to come up with a script. I would have to come up with something that would compensate for the fact that I had surrendered a little piece of my reality again. So, you know, I just multiplied. Now, I went to school, and I told you I'm a college graduate, and I always thought that something times something was something. And then I began to believe that something times nothing was still something. So I just threw away all that reality, all my intellectual understanding, and told myself, of course, something was better than nothing, when in fact, nothing was better than something. Follow me? Oh, you went to the same school as I did. So, my life wasn't turning out the way I wanted it to. You know, but of course I adored him. I'd been taught that I had to make do. And, oh, there were lots of other wonderful phrases in institutions through the 50s. You know, you make your bed, you lie in it. No, no, no. The reality was, you make the bed, he lies in it. Right? They don't teach you that. They teach you that the greater good is going to be that the head should have its rest because it's the thing that goes out to work. And, you know, it was going out to work as a pilot, so it had to be protected from crashing into things, you know. I've heard of a lot of people trying to do lots of things. You know how it is to hold a plane up in the air when you know the person has a hangover? You know, the entire morning you're watching, you're in Pensacola, Florida now, and you're watching all the little student pods go around and around in circles over a little tower, and you know he's up there, and you know he shouldn't be up there, and you hold him up there, you know, until it's time for him to come down, and please, the hardest part is to land, please let him get down. And then, of course, you know, we didn't get past flight training, although we soloed. We didn't get past flight training, and of course it was my heart that was broken, because the head had wanted it. So I've been looking back at my life lately, and I realized that I surrendered a lot more than I ever confessed to surrendering, but by the time I recognized what was doing it, you know, we were well into that little production line of our own, and I was well into having surrendered my reality. And I would say that we were probably married about 10 years only. So I had only, at that time, witnessed 10 years of periodic drinking, holiday drinking, recreational drinking, non-recreational drinking, punishment drinking, reward drinking, stinking thinking, no thinking at all. I mean, the head was not operating, and the heart was pounding every other minute. Now the heart had to turn into the head. I mean, isn't that what you do? Now there's got to be a head of the family. It was a very natural thing for me to decide I had to start thinking again. I had to start thinking for people who weren't thinking, and thinking for all the little thinkers who weren't expected to think. And so, you know, I was extremely busy, and I was always waiting. I was always waiting for the head of the house to come into my life so that my life could begin. And I would hope that it would come in at 6 so that I could stop being the head of the house. And then when it didn't come in at 7 and when it didn't come in at 8, you know, I began. Of course you wait at the window. Where else would you wait? Would you stand on the lawn and let the neighbors see you waiting? Would you let them see that you haven't had your hair done in weeks? I mean, I wouldn't stand out of doors and do that. You stand at the window, the biggest window, the one with the little lace curtains, which you have not washed in weeks because you've been busy being the head of the household as well as the heart of the household. So, of course, I stood at the window when I waited. Now, this is supposed to be my story. You know that in there is the drinking, right? Because you know the play. So, of course, the drinking is continuing. What happened to me? Well, the best little wife in the world, right, who had the brain of a potential lawyer. Now, thinking about that, it doesn't say too much for me. that's bad. I have a son who's studying law. Let's say that I had the potential, as they said in college, you know, I had real brains and potential brains, and I wasn't using either of them because I was waiting for my life to begin. So I couldn't be the best mother and the best wife. Let me tell you about a day that was kind of typical. I had sent the school-age children, by now, you know, when you have 7 children, the oldest is usually at least 7. So I was at 10 years, I had at least 3 in school, maybe 4. Okay? And I sent them to school without lunch. I was busy. What can I tell you? Well, I was busy. I'm sure I was busy looking for shoes. You know, when you have that many children, you don't teach them to find their own shoes. It's too slow. You know, much too slow. Of course you tie shoelaces. You can do that, you know, assembly line fashion. You just line them all up, you know. Bow, 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 bow. Here, let me do that, let me do that, let me do that, let me do that. And so I was busy, and so I'd sent them all off to school. The oldest, bright little fellow that he was convinced that they all needed lunch and that it was his responsibility to make up for the fact that there were no heads of the household and all hearts in the household. And he recognized, you know, that his mother was at least trying. Now, what was he, 10 years old? He decided to walk home and get the lunches. Now, that's against the law. They were going to a Roman Catholic school because I was the best Roman Catholic, right? Now, as a convert, I had to be the best Roman Catholic. I'd stopped lying in confession. I have to tell you that I achieved that by not going to confession. So the parish, the pastor, saw him going by the parish house and went out to get him because he knew that wasn't something that this child should be doing, you know, walking down the road. It wasn't too far away. But he decided that he would take this child home and together they'd pick up the lunches, which, of course, the best little wife in the county, you know, and the best mother of all these little school children, you know, had made. They both assumed that, and they came to the front door together. So let's say it was 12:10. Of course I was still in my nightgown. I was busy. And when the doorbell rang on this my typical day after, you know, whittling away my reality, I did the only thing anybody could do. I put on my fake fur coat and I went to answer the door. It had no buttons, you know. Fur coats don't have buttons. And, of course, with this wrapped around me in the elegance of my bare feet and my, I'm sure, worn flannel gown, I went to the front door. And to my horror, in spite of my best efforts, this dear sweet man slipped by me talking some drivel about picking up the children's lunches. Now, I had hoped that he would not make it to the kitchen before I did, but alas and alack, he certainly did. Now, the kitchen windows opened onto a deck. I remember that it had snowed. I remembered that I had let the dog out onto the back deck because I was much too busy to walk the dog. That's also where I had put the garbage for several days because I was much too busy and too concerned to remember which days were garbage pickup days, and there were only two a week. And the dog and the garbage and the dog's natural functions were all quite exposed because I had taken the curtains down because they got in the way of looking and waiting. I kid you not. I will set the rest of the scene. There was a large picnic table. That's what we ate at. That's what he slept on the benches, you know, after I had bought him the beer so that he, for the greater good of the peace of the head. Yeah. There was also an overstuffed chair in the kitchen because one of the children was sick, and I thought he would be more comfortable in the kitchen where I had put the television set. So I would have something to watch while I was looking out the window in the evening. Next to him on the floor was, of course, the giant economy size jar of peanut butter with a very large knife sticking out of it. I'm sure I was going to make my best meal, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And, you know, the priest in his long flowing cassock and his sash with the tassels swept through that scene, you know, turned around to face me, and to my horror, he had managed to pick up the knife out of the peanut butter jar unknowingly in the tassel of his cassock. And if you think I gesture, you should have seen the action of that knife. And then the question became to tell him or not to tell him, to grab it or not to grab it, to let him take the damn thing back with him. It was also a cold day, and I prayed to God that he didn't need to use the John because, of course, we didn't have paper disposable diapers at the time, and of course, I had several children in and out of diapers, and I remember thinking, oh, dear God, why? Not why didn't you make the lunches? Why did he have to come now when I would have had all this under control later in the day so that my higher power, you know, when he came home, this head of the household would have had some serenity. I was going to get to all of this. You know, somewhere around 3 o'clock, I certainly would have gotten at least the diapers out of the John. Because I would have needed them, you see. What else had happened to me? 10 years, let's see. Oh, yes. I went through a period of losing the children. My daughter will tell you that this is true. I haven't told this story to too many people, but I did lose them. I would go out with 7, come back with 5. The telephone would ring, and I would say, "Hello, who's this?" And some child would say, "Mom?" I wasn't aware that anybody was, you know, within telephoning distance. And I would say, "Who is this?" And, you know, this voice would say, usually it was one of the older ones, naturally, because I had assigned them all these family jobs. It'd say, "This is Jeff. I'm inside the store where you dropped me off to get the ice, and you drove right by again." And I would have to go and get you. One day, one of the major store chain managers called me, and he said, "Mrs. McF..." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, this is the manager." And I said, "You know, this long story..." Always had an answer at the ready. "About how I would cover the check. I'm so sorry I said that, because..." He soon let me know that's not why he was calling. Oh, I was into creative bank keeping, you know, bank accounts then. I would have 2. They call it kiting checks. I thought it was creative. You know, it took so many days for a check to be passed, and I would then deposit it over there. I thought it was very clever of me. I had no idea I could go to jail for such a thing. And if you told anybody today that I did that, I will deny. However, he said, "We were wondering when you were coming back for Frank." Frank was 2. Well, maybe he was 2 and a half, because he had spent about 2 hours or so putting prices on cans, and he was getting bored, and they wondered if I was coming back for him. If the car broke down, it invariably had me, 7 children, and melting ice cream in it. I was very ready for some solution other than one I had been able to write or not able to write. And when it came in 2 blue suits, oh yes, AA comes in blue suits in New Jersey, dressed to the nines, as it were. They do believe in dressing up to go on 12-step calls. I was very glad. I was very glad because I had had it with the head of the household, and my heart was very definitely broken. There have been so many things in my life that I had never expected, and certainly I didn't realize that by surrendering my reality a little bit at a time, I was not in a dream world, folks. I was in a nightmare world. I made up so much of my life in order to get through my life that I didn't know where reality began and ended anymore. And I have to tell you that I almost didn't care. I really almost didn't care. At that point, I was probably more real than I got later. Okay, so the story is just about the same, except that sobriety was the answer within a day. Within the first day of AA, sobriety was the answer. And the men who, was the solution. And the men who had come to take the head of the household away came back to speak to this aching heart and mentioned Al-Anon. Now, in most every story that I've ever seen, and certainly in this one, the primary characters welcomed being welcomed. Well, I have to tell you, I didn't grow up with alcoholism, but certainly in 10 years of living with it, I was not ready to be welcomed by anybody. And I certainly had all of the fallout and all of the effects of a very negative disease on my life, because, you see, I had written a new script. And that wasn't it. Mine was, you know, to hold back and not be accepting and to be very judgmental. Now, I had a great deal offered to me, as I have had through a great deal of my life. I think some of the reason that so much happens in my life in particular, or seems to have happened in my life in particular, is that I was very passionate about living. And I was more than willing to risk. And I certainly like to put myself outside of the crowd almost as much as I liked to be hiding in it or accepted by it. The funny thing about it is that I always operated best with an audience. I'm very comfortable talking to other people. See, maybe it's in the genes. It's probably a little something of everything, just like my theory. All I know is how it was, and that was that when I went to Al-Anon the first time, I was arrogant, intolerant, vain, definitely underdressed. It's so funny, you know, a fine tooth comb. You have 7 children, there's never a comb in the entire house. I had parted my hair with a salad fork to go to that meeting. But I do remember condemning most of the people there for the fact that they had had their hair done. Well, of course I would have had my hair done if I could have afforded to have my hair done. You know, I identify with martyr. I mean, I was a wonderful martyr. I was an exceptional martyr. The difference is I thought it was genuine. I didn't realize I had written the script for martyrdom. You know, and I thought that their script was better for martyrdom than mine. I mean, I was not singing. It's funny, though. Pain and painful expressions were probably music to my ears because I was so familiar with them. And so I put myself in many painful situations after Al-Anon. The very first thing I did to put myself in a painful situation and maintain my martyrdom was to get into a corner of the room where people were not talking about the program, but where people in their own humanness were talking about him. And my head of the household took on a whole new aura. I still see some of this today. It scares me, witless. I see sometimes a glorification of other people because they have a certain disease as opposed to another disease. You know. And so I took that up. You know, that was my cudgel. Now, he was my alcoholic. You know, and my alcoholic was sober. First shot out of the basket, right? You know, first meeting, never took another drink. My alcoholic. And I've said in other places, and I repeat this because I really feel that it was a terrible thing to do, although I know some people who don't think it's a terrible thing to do and see it as a loving kind of acceptance of their life. So that's all right, too. It's something of everything, right? And I used to say it like it was my purse, some kind of belonging, you know. Did I leave my alcoholic in here? Well, you know, of course, if I'd had more, if I knew better, if I'd been different, it would have worked out differently. But I already told you I had this trouble with math, you know, and making do and not recognizing that I was entering the race so that I could be a winner. I thought I entered the race so the relationship could be the winner. And then later on, I felt I was in this race, in this competitive world of Al-Anon-ism, you know, to be the best Al-Anon member now that I could be, for the greater good of the greater number. I mixed up a lot of things. And by writing a lot of scripts and by seeing myself as smarter than most, I was profoundly ignorant and not qualified to be welcomed. And certainly not recovering at a rate where I might have. And, you know, things were coming up, but they weren't coming up roses necessarily. So it wasn't too long that in sobriety, the head of the household didn't want to be the head of that particular household anymore. And, you know, that broke my heart. because I had made these sacrifices in the name of recovery, and I had pledged myself to a new way of life in Al-Anon and surrendered this head to AA because that was going to be the solution. So there were different glitches in this play, you know, in this, and this little novella that I was writing, you know, was now taking on gigantic proportions and always very dramatic. Of course they had to be dramatic. I was by nature an impassioned person. And so I thought I would die when I was about to be left. Because I didn't think it was fair. I mean, hadn't I amended some of my attitudes? Of course, then I thought I had amended all of them, because only some of them had been revealed to me. I was very lucky. I didn't kill anybody, and nobody killed me. That is the bottom line of luck if you are hell-bent on writing somebody else's script and giving away your reality a little bit at a time. So I just switched my allegiance. I just switched my surrender and my dependence to Al-Anon people, and I saw the fourth step as confession. Of course I lied. Who wouldn't lie? I mean, I had raised my awareness and my consciousness, you know, up. What I didn't recognize is that I had started, you know, way down here someplace. I mean, underhanded, under the table, undermining. I didn't know I was doing those things. I didn't have all that knowledge. I didn't have all that understanding. And I certainly didn't have all that self-worth. So I decided that what I was, you know when they say some of us are sicker than others? Okay, so that was my part then. I was the some of us are sicker than others. And you know something? Nobody threw me out of Al-Anon because of that. Do you honestly think that I cared about the 12 steps? I didn't understand them. I couldn't deal with them. I could say that I appreciated them or saw them intellectually because I was responding a little better with my head. You know, so I was really better off alone. Because alone, I didn't have the object of my affection, you know, to change my complexion. I just had me and my Al-Anon people because they were the only friends I had at the time. So I began going to Al-Anon, you know, with a little different perspective. And the wonderful part about recovery for me was that even though I had gotten sick a slice at a time and a day at a time, I got better squared. I mean, the first time that I understood what living one day at a time could mean for me, I could multiply that by 365 days of potential. And, you know, at least I was in the positive column. I was no longer a negative number. I was starting at go, and I was going to collect my $200, and I was going to move forward. I began to understand that the simple slogans that were offered in Al-Anon were offered for me. Because, you see, I didn't have my alcoholic in the household, so I didn't have to relate everything to my relationship. I could just relate it to how I was going to get through that day. I remember not cooking for 6 weeks, and then saying to the kids, you know, I kind of like it when we all had dinner together. I thought I cooked that dinner so that my higher power would come up the driveway and get fed. And then I recognized that I cooked that dinner because I liked to eat that dinner and I enjoyed sitting down with my family and I enjoyed the camaraderie that we were beginning to share around a table. And they all said they liked that too. And I didn't realize that I cooked for the king and fed the serfs, you know, with the leftovers. Somebody who shall remain nameless at the end of the table said to me one day, "Oh, yes, the king gets steak." I think she was probably 8. She recognized that. "The king gets steak and the rest of us get chopped beef. And don't eat that apple. Your father might want that apple. That's the last apple. Your father might want it." So I didn't have to operate that way anymore. So we moved into what I call my chapter 11. You know, the funniest thing about it is we say, you know, you're spiritually bankrupt. You know what happens in the real world, in reality, okay, and I learned this in school, is that if you declare bankruptcy and you sign the papers, your past debts are forgiven. Now, I had, in my first few years in Al-Anon, gotten to the place where I could admit that I was bankrupt, but I couldn't bear to sign the papers. You see, because I didn't recognize, you know, I could no longer do something in potential anymore. I had to do something that had a little bit to do with reality. So I had to come back through all of this stuff to get, so I could start. And as I began to do that, I began to feel better. I began to understand that think meant think for Linda. The children were older. The children were beginning to think. And they were very bright about thinking about how they could get me to stop doing their thinking. And there were, after all, seven of them. And I told you it was hard to remember their names, and that didn't get any easier. And they certainly had more friends as they got older. But they began to think for themselves. And since they were not in trouble, I could let them do that. And it was really nice to let a 14-year-old tie his own shoes. So, and I mean, and to find them. You know, the day I surrendered and I stopped looking for shoes, I could begin the real hard work of an Al-Anon member, and that's looking for the car keys. That's very definitely true. You know that someone's in Al-Anon and that they're in trouble and that their serenity level has a great deal to do with whether or not they can find the car keys within 3 to 5 minutes. Amen, right. And whether or not they've locked them in the car to begin with. But I have to tell you, I seldom did that. I couldn't find them to open the car door to begin with. So I began to get better because I began to listen to the program, because I began to focus on myself, something I hadn't been able to do for years. You know, I was an impassioned person. And when the opportunity presented itself for me to renew my relationship, I grabbed it. I was more than willing to sacrifice all that newfound freedom, knowledge, emotional stability, serenity, the capacity to think for myself, the very minute that he turned on and that man wanted to walk back into my life. But I didn't give up Al-Anon, because in that period of separation, that had been the only thing that was mine, and I had at least gotten to go. So, you know, Act 2 and Act 3 were just like that. If you don't have all that it takes and you act with your, and you think with your heart instead of your head, and you're an impassioned person and you haven't learned that much in Al-Anon about letting go, and you have no connection to your higher power, when the opportunity presents itself, the chances are that your behavior is going to be the same. My behavior was the same. I understand it now. So we had a little more of the same. And it didn't take too long, you know, before that all folded in on itself and the old habit patterns reappeared. And I began thinking for two people and acting for two people and rolled up my sleeves and just got to work. And, you know, as the children were going out of the household, and they, you know, they tend to do that when they get to be a certain age, and especially when their mother tells them they have to go at 22. You know, I was just, yeah, we had a rule in the house, 22 skidoo. And, you know, I ended up being a fairly decent mother out of numbers again. Because they had each other, and that tends to happen in a lot of alcoholic households. The children are either in a healthy way interdependent or in an unhealthy way interdependent. And fortunately, because there was so much program so early on, and at least I was spouting it to these children who were bright, who would occasionally spout it back to me. Hey, Mom, easy does it, Mom. You know, hey, Mom, aren't you supposed to think? And, you know, I had to get myself a sponsor in Al-Anon. I remember the first time I had one assigned to me. And I had already assigned. It was self-defensive for the group. Absolutely. I understand it today. But I remember saying to this person, you know, I thought this was a program of choice. She said, I didn't have any. And she was right, because I wasn't even at a level yet where I could make a choice about who was going to help me learn this program, because I was too smart. I knew much too much in order to know anything. I mean, all of my reality was turned inside out. You can be too smart to learn. I was a teacher. I went right out, you know, and made a living teaching. So I was beginning to put myself back out into the world again. And what kept me as a good teacher was that there were so many students in the class, I couldn't ruin them. You know, you have kind of even odds if you have a teacher and 24 students. I mean, they keep you on your toes, but you can't really spoil them, and you can't think for all of them. And so, you know, I was able then to begin the process of, let's call it my intellectual recovery. I was beginning to read again. I was beginning to share things I had learned. And I was beginning to get a little better. Physically, oh, I always went on a diet. You know, I always went on a diet. First of all, I lost my appetite when I was left alone. And in the second place, I would begin to concentrate on my own physical well-being, and I wouldn't always cook all these things that were fattening and meant to make up for the fact that I couldn't do anything else for anybody. So I would make chocolate chip cookies. You know, that we have lots of problems that are related to this disease that don't have to do with this disease when we're just acting like hearts. Usually that goes with overfeeding somebody. And so I did that. But when this, you know, head of the household didn't want to be the head of the household again, I can remember suffering a great deal, but not falling back to where I had in the beginning. Okay. So now we're up to, chapter 24. In the last 19 years that I've been in Al-Anon, I would venture to say that there were three major separations, the last beginning about 6 months ago. I honestly think that being forced to look back in a different way, and I hope telling you some of the different things I learned about myself, I haven't scared anybody. Because I certainly don't mean to scare you by saying to you, look, this is the way it was. This is how Al-Anon changed my life. And this is how I feel today. This is my story. And sometimes, you know, stories have one kind of an ending, and sometimes they have another. But I know, as an old storyteller from long ago, that, you know, the opera ain't over till the fat lady sings. Since I no longer consider myself the fat lady, and since I don't plan on singing, I expect that some of these things are going to continue happening to me as I go through the rest of my life 24 hours at a time. Let me tell you, I think that I could say that three of my children are very warmly attached to Al-Anon. To my knowledge, none of them has a major drinking or drug problem. To my knowledge, they turned out to be bright, attractive. Bright, attractive, loving people. So, 7 out of 7, I think. I say to myself, you know, you didn't ruin them. I don't care. The reason I don't is that they're all spiritual. They have shown a great deal of loving affection for me and for their father, a great deal of tolerance for both of us. The bottom line is that they didn't murder us, and we didn't murder them. All of them are now over 18, and I am no longer legally responsible for their choices. They have all gone or are going or to college. That's been their choice. That's not why it's a success story. Although I'm extremely grateful, Lord, I'm extremely grateful because I have so much caring for them. And occasionally my head does get full for them. But I have learned in Al-Anon to let them go. I had a lot of practice letting them go. If I'd had 7 husbands, I might have done better. Although I think about it, I probably had 7 chances at this one person who has chosen to do what he's chosen to do. But what? We don't have any control over our experiences. And instead of asking the same questions anymore, instead of asking the questions I asked as a child, and I know this is kind of distracted, and I just can't help myself, because the last thing in the world I wanted to do, you have to understand, is quote me. Now, I've been a lot of places, and I've told my story to a lot of people, and I still have a way with words, and I've been hired to produce them, and oftentimes I've been hired, in a sense, to come and you know, paid for to travel and to speak and to share. And I asked myself what it was I was supposed to be here for. And I think I'm supposed to be here for the same reasons that anybody talks in either of these programs. And that's because we're supposed to share our experience, strength, and hope. Sometimes my experience is profoundly more interesting than somebody else's experience. I understand that because it's very dramatic, and sometimes I am. And sometimes I can even be very amusing. And I love to have people laugh. And I love not to take myself too seriously. And sometimes, and a lot of the time lately, I've cried a lot. And I don't care to cry anymore. So when I asked myself what it was I was going to say, I didn't ask myself whether or not I deserved the opportunity to say it. Because I understand that today. Each of us, we're a fellowship of equals, and we all have and should have the opportunity to share what we think and you know, where we've come from. Because, you know, we say in this program, take what you like and leave the rest. So, you know, I know that today I just hope, and I said this at the dinner table, I just hope that some people are willing to leave the rest. Because, you know, we're all so different. It's true we're all so different. But the same program is what made my life bearable. And I think that's the point, that the Al-Anon program is qualifying each of us for living and for not waiting for our lives to begin or not living our lives through other people. I don't think we do it alone. I've heard a lot of people say, oh, you can be anything you want to be. I don't think that's so. They say you can have anything you want to have. I don't think that's so either. But I do think we can choose to be part of anything we choose to be part of, or we can choose not to be part of something. Now, I've chosen to remain a member of Al-Anon. Sure, you can say, well, you're such a slow learner. I mean, you know, it's taken you all this time to get what they got. You know, they got that in a couple of, you know, couple of meetings. And, you know, there are people who get it. Young people come into Al-Anon today, lots of them. And, you know, they're willing to listen. They're willing to sit down up front. They're willing to take what they like and leave the rest. They're willing to read the literature and not see other people in it. They're willing to take their own inventories and not take other people's inventories. They're more than willing to believe they're powerless over other human beings or alcoholism. They're more than willing to admit the fact that their lives have become unmanageable. I know lots of people in this program today reach right out for a higher power, see a higher power as in a personal way, riding in the car with them, going through life with them. I've heard them. I've benefited from them. Some of them are even my children. I'll tell you something else. I know people who could say the third step when they open their eyes in the morning, and that's what they told me to say when I opened my eyes and my reality flooded in, and I didn't like it, and I didn't want it. And they said to me, just say, thy will be done, thy will be done, thy will be done. And you know something? The longer I was in this program, the dumber I got. Thank you, God. I got so that I finally knew I didn't know anything. You know, is that the funniest thing? I mean, I went to Al-Anon to learn that I didn't know anything. I was such a slow learner, it's taken me 19 years. I learned to travel with tapes of Al-Anon speakers in my car. I worked at the World Service Office for years. Do you know how many times I've suggested that to people who told me they had to take a long trip and didn't know how they were going to get from one Al-Anon meeting to another? Do you understand that for much of my life I was able to see pictures and write words that let other people see things I couldn't see? That I was able to put words together and have people convinced of things I found so hard to believe myself? Do you know the pain of being on the outside and observing life and being cursed with a brain that knows it? You know something? The reason all my life I wanted to come to California at one time or another, and I was thinking about that, I can remember saying, oh, well, if he leaves or if he dies, I'll pack up the kids and go to California. Do you know that California has been in my unreal life and in my potential life for so long? Do you have any idea how thrilled I always am to come to California? Because it's real. Do you know how super it is to know so little that your reality becomes your best friend? I mean, that's where I am today. That's what I'm supposed to be saying to you. I'm supposed to be saying to you, I learned in Al-Anon to forgive. I learned in Al-Anon to forget. I learned in Al-Anon to go on. But the most important thing I've learned lately is not to be a damn fool about it all. And that's extraordinary. You know, I can be impassioned without having to act on every feeling. Do you know what I learned in Al-Anon? To get out of touch with my feelings. I mean, I had enough for everybody. You know, for the people who want and are looking for parents in Al-Anon, here's, you know, I'm Earth Mother. You want me to act like your mother? I know exactly how to act like a mother. I'm telling you, this is what a mother owes her children. Hi, honey. You're the brightest, most intelligent person I've seen all day. And whatever it is you're going to go out there and do, I know you can do it. I love you, and I think you're wonderful. Now, that's a good mother, right? And a good mother also says, when are you going to clean up your room? And a good mother says, remember to brush your teeth. And a good mother answers every question why with the same answer I've learned to accept. Because. Because that's your reality. Now I only ask myself one question. Recognizing that this is my reality, what, if anything, am I prepared to do about it? I'm prepared to do a lot more than I was ever prepared to do before. I'm prepared because I'm really dumb. Because I recognize the fact that a lot of people know better than I do, and that they're sitting in Al-Anon rooms around the world, thank God. Because the chances are that my higher power has in store for me lots of travel. And I need Al-Anon to be wherever it is my funny, passionate heart takes me. Risk? I'll risk everything every day. As long as I can have my reality and I can have the higher power of my choosing beside me. You know, sitting in my lap, I have a very personal view of higher power. So I don't know whether or not I've entertained. I don't even know whether or not I've said things that I haven't said before. All I know is that I've come to the point in my life where I can genuinely say to people I love, I honestly don't care if I pleased you. I did what I needed to do today, the best I could, the best way I knew how, having asked my higher power to make me grateful for what I've got, and not willing to make up stories about what I haven't got. I hope Al-Anon lasts forever. I think at least you all recognize that I need it too. Thanks very much.